Welcome to the second part of Chapter 5 of our series, trying to answer the question, are we heading to a dystopian future? In this part, we will start our journey into the societal and socio-political characteristics depicted in the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. If you haven't seen or heard Part 1, you might want to go back to it. Also, this would be a perfect time to give this a thumbs up and maybe share it with someone. Or even, use the links in the description to buy the book off Amazon or Audible, or use any of the other links in which you can support my work. Let's start exploring the societal and socio-political characteristics of PKD's masterpiece, starting with 1. Emotional control. Anyone who has read the book might find it odd that I'm starting with this item before all other aspects that depict Rick Deckard's world and society. However, given that the book itself begins with emotional control, I shall too. Unlike other works that describe oppressive, overbearing regimes that control people's emotion by force, in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, people themselves seem more than happy, or unhappy, to induce artificial feelings, or, more accurately, moods. Although this is a privilege reserved only to those who can afford the device that regulates moods, the Penfield Mood Organ. The Penfield Mood Organ is an electronic device that allows users to enter single to triple digit combinations such as 3, 594, 888, and so on, similar to a combination lock. Each combination a user dials on the Penfield Mood Organ elicits a different mood, with additional settings in the form of letters that control the mood's intensity. The moods the device can induce range from the comically mundane, such as the desire to watch TV no matter what's on it, to the comically absurd, like the desire to want to dial the mood organ itself. However, the deeper you dig into the book, the bleaker these two settings seem. The TV, for instance, is either a channel spewing a single never-ending mind-numbing talk show, or the government TV, which does little more than advertise immigration to Mars. The settings that make you want to get a mood illustrates something even more profound. As if moods don't come naturally anymore, or that senses have become too dull to experience feelings in their fullness. So dull, in fact, that the mood organ can also induce negative feelings. In other words, in this post-apocalyptic world, people are so emotionally drained that they need an artificial mood controller to both escape and experience the sorry state of their world and life. All of the above obviously resonates with the book's theme, exploring the question of real and fake. If an artificial, on-demand mood feels just as authentic, what makes it fake? Moreover, an obvious question arises. If human moods can be synthetic, aren't future humans a kind of android themselves? That said, PKD does make sure to point out the ridiculous nature of the device and, by extension, how silly humans are. This is most evident when we are first introduced to the mood organ at the beginning of the book with an argument between Rick and his wife, Erin. The book first starts with the following. A merry little surge of electricity, piped by automatic alarm from the mood organ beside his bed, awakened Rick Deckard. Surprised, it always surprised him to find himself awake without prior notice, he rose from the bed, stood up, and stretched. Now, in her bed, His wife, Erin, opened her gray, unmerry eyes, blinked, then groaned, and shut her eyes again. "You set your Penfield too weak," he said to her. "I'll reset it, and you'll be awake, and..." "Keep your hands off my settings," her voice held bitter sharpness. "I don't want to be awake." He seated himself beside her, bent over her, and explained softly, "If you set the surge up high enough, you'll be glad you're awake. That's the whole point. At setting C, it overcomes the threshold barring consciousness, as it does for me." End quote. By the way, in case you haven't noticed, it seems Rick and Erin don't share the same bed, saying something about their marriage. Regardless, their discussion devolves into an argument after the portion I quoted. It starts with Erin telling him that she heard, by chance, the horrifying silence of the empty apartments in their buildings, a consequence of the mass die-off of humans and the evacuation to Mars. To quote Erin, "At that moment, I had the TV sound off. I was in a 382 mood. I had just dialed it, so although I heard the emptiness intellectually, I didn't feel it. My first reaction consisted of being grateful that we could afford a Penfield mood organ. But then I read how unhealthy it was, sensing the absence of life, not just in this building, but everywhere, and not reacting to it. Do you see? I guess you don't. But that used to be considered a sign of mental illness. They called it absence of appropriate affect. So I left the TV sound off, and I sat down at my mood organ, and I experimented, and I finally found a setting for despair." Her dark, pert face showed satisfaction, as if she had achieved something of worth. "So I put it on my schedule for twice a month. I think that's a reasonable amount of time to feel hopeless about everything, about staying here on Earth." End quote. Rick doesn't seem to approve and warns her of the dangers of this artificial despair, which leads to one of the dumb exchanges we tend to have with our spouses. At some point, Rick contemplates whether to dial a mood that will end the argument by abolishing his rage or increasing his irritation to win the argument. Noticing it, his wife threatens to turn her mood organ to maximum venom to make it the worst fight they've ever had. And I'm sure anyone in a relationship can relate. By the way, in case you are in a relationship and wonder how it was resolved, PKD doesn't leave you hanging. Rick eventually takes his wife's mood organ and dials for her setting 594. Pleased acknowledgement of husband's superior wisdom in all matters, which I'm sure quite a few men could do with. Anyway, I think you get the point. In PKD's dystopian future, humans are almost forced to control their moods to both escape and experience their emotions. However, this privilege is reserved only for those who can afford it, which I will discuss later. Before we go on, if you disagree with anything I said, please make sure to leave a comment. And if you like what you've heard, use this little break to give a thumbs up and even subscribe to my channel. Anyway, now let's go on to the political and geopolitical side of things. And here, at number two, we have superstates and international governance. Unlike most dystopian future works, the government depicted in the book, specifically the American one, is not a totalitarian regime mistreating humans. In fact, on the surface, governments seem benign, both that of the United States and Soviet Russia, which are the only governments mentioned by name. Even when describing what led to the war, PKD points the finger at the military-industrial complex, more than the belligerent powers themselves. Special mention is reserved for the American non-profit think tank, the RAND Corporation. In case you didn't know, the RAND Corporation was conceived by the Douglas Aircraft Company to offer the US government strategic advice in security, advice which usually ended up benefiting companies like the Douglas Aircraft Company. Shocking, I know. It is important to remember that this book was written at the height of the Cold War, when the RAND Corporation's main study subjects were nuclear deterrence, geopolitical game theory, and theories on the future of war. I guess PKD was skeptical of their work. Anyhow, in the book, our two superpowers were now closely cooperating to capture and eliminate rogue androids, including exchanging law enforcement officers and sharing technology. Interestingly, communist or not, the Soviet Union has representatives of android manufacturers on their soil. Mind you, these corporations are privately held and profit-motivated, which doesn't chime well with communism. Then again, these corporations are endorsed by the UN, and we all know that communists are infatuated with internationalism. So, let's devote some attention to the UN. In PKD's dystopian world, the UN plays a significant role in coordinating and setting rules, especially as they pertain to preserving life and evacuating humans to Mars. Mind you, the Martian colony is mentioned as an explicitly American endeavor, but somehow controlled by the UN. In fact, the UN seems to be governing and overseeing anything concerning the immigration to Mars. And while a worthy and lofty goal, they are far from being the good guys. Just take this quote as an example. The android had been the ultimate incentive of immigration. The android servant as carrot, the radioactive fallout as stick. The UN had made it easy to emigrate, difficult, if not impossible, to stay. End quote. This strikes me as an awful condemnation of the UN. Working under the guise of the good of mankind, the UN is actively making it harder to stay on Earth, and the incentive they give? Organic beings as slaves. If that's not a dystopian regime, I don't know what is. PKD also names the UN's Secretary General as one Titus Corning. Given his Christian faith, I'm going to assume PKD is hinting at Titus, the Roman Emperor who fought the Jews and laid waste to the Jewish temple. And given PKD's view of megacorporations and the book's theme, Corning might be a wink at the Dow Corning Corporation that, in the 60s, invented the fake silicon boob. This is just me postulating, but knowing PKD, I'm willing to bet a shilling or two on it. To further the point about the power and less than virtuous motives of the UN, let me give some more examples. First, the UN allows android manufacturers to work under what is known as colonial law, which supersedes governments. For instance, law enforcement agencies from the USA and the Soviet Union try to force the Nexus 6 manufacturer to take the advanced android off the market. But when the manufacturer refused, the governments were left helpless to do anything about it because they are under the UN's Martian jurisdiction. Another example of the UN's role in this world is that if someone was lucky enough to find an animal believed to be extinct, the UN, not a government, would award them with a Star of Honor and a reward of millions of dollars. As mentioned in the quote, the UN is also credited in the book with coming up with the law that humans that emigrate can pick whatever android they like to be their slave. This, mind you, would make them more aligned with the android manufacturers than with governments, which might shed a light on the fact that they didn't make manufacturers pull the new advanced androids off the market. This might hint at some kind of corporatism at an international level, but it is not explicitly mentioned, so I won't put words in PKD's mouth. Going back to governments, while, as I've said, there is no obvious sign of governments being coercive and evil, they don't come off as righteous either. Obviously, it was governments that started World War Terminus to begin with, so there's that. But also, governments still pushed for the evacuation of Earth despite the radioactive dust cloud settling. It isn't that the situation on Earth isn't dire. It just seems that no effort is made to salvage or recover Earth. Leaving Earth is the only solution considered, despite some people wishing to stay. This, of course, might be just a plot device. But having read a lot of PKD, I can tell you that he's very careful with his choice of plot devices. Additionally, the government, at least the American one, doesn't seem to care too much about the undesirable specials, those who are not allowed to emigrate due to genetic degeneration. Worse still, specials are sterilized to ensure they do not reproduce. Put more bluntly, governments ensure that specials won't contaminate the race, reverting this world back to the dark days of eugenics. I will get into the specials in more detail when describing class division. Still, I will give a simple example. Since the only people allowed to emigrate to Mars are those who can safely reproduce, males need to wear lead codpieces on their genitals to protect their testes. However, it is hinted that good and sophisticated codpieces that provide good protection come at a price. Therefore, just how much the government cares for human life is put in doubt. After all, if governments truly cared that much for the sanctity of life, wouldn't they be handing them out for free? Although, this might be yet another of PKD's jabs at the inhumane side of capitalism, which brings me to the next point. 3. Evil corporations. If there's one thing many people on the left and right can agree on, including mega-capitalists like me, it is that large corporations often end up behaving psychopathically, much like androids, devoid of empathy or care for life. This, mind you, is the excuse used to justify ESG-type coercive control measures forcing companies to obey weird rules like diversity hiring, an overtly racist practice, or, for that matter, the World Economic Forum's stakeholder capitalism, which unfortunately has nothing to do with stakeholders nor capitalism. Just another scheme to get us to a heavenly plutocracy wrapped in a green and sustainable pride flag. Okay, now that I've taken that off my chest, let's go back from our evil corporations to the ones PKD describes. Corporations are portrayed in the book by shining a light on the manufacturers of androids. One, called the Rosen Association, plays a central part in the plot as they produce the Nexus 6 type androids. We first learn about the Rosen Association when we learn that law enforcement agencies try to make them withdraw the Nexus 6s from the market. Something I've mentioned in the last point. At first, it seems like this is simple profit motive in action. After all, it is explicitly mentioned in the book that they made this advanced model in the first place due to customers' demand. But things get more complicated, specifically when we look at the Rosen Association's interactions with Rick Deckard. There, we get the explicit impression that they are trying to prevent the elimination of androids. This might be ascribed to profit motive if it's just a way to hide the slight issue of their product murdering its users, which might prove to be less than popular with prospective customers. Still, as Rick Deckard observes, it looks as if they are trying to protect their products, or preserve their lives, if you will. Allow me to illustrate. In the first interaction with Rick, the Rosen Association tries to discredit the Voight-Kampff empathy test by which androids are detected. They try to make Rick think he mistakenly identified a human as an android, rendering the test unusable for obvious reasons. But this would mean they would have to pull Nexus 6 off the market, which makes little sense for a corporation. Then, they threaten Rick's job, telling him they'll show a recording of the session where he was fooled to his boss. In other words, they're trying to take out the bounty hunter tasked with killing their androids. Then, they try to bribe him with an animal, specifically an owl. Importantly, owls were the first animals to die from the fallout. But here's the thing. They tried to bribe him with a fake owl, meaning they're trying to compromise him. After all, who exactly will he tell about his fraudulent bribe? The cops? Furthermore, when the Rosen Association offers to assign an android to help Rick capture the rogue androids, the android assigned to help him is only willing to come if it will persuade him to give up retiring the last three remaining Nexus 6 androids. Now, remember, they are effectively trying to preserve the life of androids that killed humans. This doesn't put the Rosen Association in a positive light, to say the least. Moreover, making them more intelligent makes them better at deceiving their way out of the Voight-Kampff empathy test. For example, one of the androids tries to persuade Rick that she's not a native English speaker and therefore doesn't understand his questions. And then she pulls a Me Too on him by calling the cops, accusing him of being a pervert because some of the questions are of a promiscuous nature. And here's the kicker. The police station she calls is a fake one, staffed by androids. I can go on exploring this issue and their possible motives. For instance, the governments are more interested in making a fake Earth on Mars, and corporations are more interested in making fake humans than saving real ones. Still, I don't want to veer too much into speculation. Instead, let's proceed to something we can all closely associate with corporations. So, at number 4, we have consumerism. The society in PKD's book is not hedonistically consumerist like the one in, say, Huxley's Brave New World. Instead, they are compelled to consume to survive at extreme prices. After all, with everything on Earth being scarce, everything is expensive, and with everything being so essential, demand is high enough to keep it that way. So, what is it that is essential? Well, men must buy expensive cod pieces to protect their testes and sperm, without which they might lose their right to emigrate to Mars. Then, there's the aforementioned mood organ, without which life seems almost unbearable. Now, while not a matter of absolute necessity, owning animals, real or fake, is essential for a sense of self-worth, moral duty, and place in society. Mind you, this is morality of the religious kind, not the be a good dude thing, and we'll explore this in depth later. But the point is that being almost a holy commandment makes it essential on a much deeper level. And as I've explained in the overview, with supply low and demand high, owning an animal comes at a hefty premium, from purchasing to maintenance. And hefty premiums, as you can imagine, also mean ownership of animals is a status symbol, a way to show how wealthy you are, and, maybe more importantly, how virtuous, just in case you're not religiously inclined. To back this claim, I'll mention an interesting point made in the book about how rich people own 2, 3, and even 4 animals, while others can't afford one, something which Rick finds immoral and against the tenets of their religion. Additionally, one of Rick's neighbors boasts that he had to fly to Canada to get his particular kind of horse, a horse which, he says, people in Colorado or Wyoming will steal from you if they had the chance. Because if you've seen Yellowstone, you know how those people are when it gets to horses. The only place where consumerism, or greed if you like to call it that, gets a little less benign is with the humanoid android slaves being an incentive to emigrate. But I'm not sure I can call that a sign of consumerism. Instead, in my mind, it makes an interesting point about slavery. You see, to hold their noses, so to speak, post-Enlightenment Western societies were morally forced to assume people of specific skin colors were not human. Luckily, unlike in the Muslim world and brutal states like China, our own Western societies gave up on the mental backflips required to justify slavery and banned it, regardless of the economic impact of losing something as pleasing as free labor. Okay, so, now with evil corporations and consumerism behind us, we naturally get to point number 5, class division. Now, this is where PKD gets more serious about social commentary rather than philosophical dilemmas. Although, being the genius that he was, he did manage to tie them all together in a nice little mind-bending bundle. First, there's the obvious socio-economic divisions between the haves and have-nots. With the haves, just like in our world, there are different subclasses, mainly based on the type and number of animals you own. Just as an example, when Rick goes shopping for an animal, the salesman tells him, "I'd like to see you step up to the goat class, where I feel you belong." Since I already covered this in the last point, I want to dive into some serious class divisions. At the end of the last point, I already mentioned the connection between the treatment of androids and slavery, which will make the following easier to grasp. While it is obvious that androids are not sentient in the same way humans are, and in fact pose a threat to humans, it is still not at all evident that they are mere mindless machines. Quite the opposite, in fact. Hopefully, you agree that lack of empathy does not justify enslaving your run-of-the-mill psychopath, which already puts the morality of this action in question. And it's even worse when it's plainly obvious they wish to be free. Therefore, I can only conclude that enslaving androids is as immoral as enslaving humans. But this is where class comes in. Now, please note, we're not talking about socioeconomic classes like in the modern capitalist societies, including the most unequal ones. The class to which androids belong is more akin to the classes one finds in racial-based regimes like Nazi Germany or South African apartheid. Androids are, as a matter of fact, not human, and therefore are not afforded any rights a human would have. Similarly, Jews under the Nazis and blacks under apartheid were considered subhuman in one way or another, justifying the blatant injustice they were made to endure. At this point, you can pull a utilitarian human supremacy case which might hold some merit. But then you encounter the uncomfortable fact that androids are, as far as society is concerned, almost on par with the genetically degenerated specials. The specials, as I've mentioned, are genetically degenerated humans, with those dubbed chicken heads suffering from mental retardedness and low cognitive abilities. In fact, it is made explicitly clear in the book that the Nexus 6 androids are more intelligent than many chicken heads. And without going all Godwin on you, I can only describe society's treatment of specials as Nazi-like, but without the extermination and camps and stuff. To clarify, let me quote. Loitering on Earth potentially meant finding oneself abruptly classed as biologically unacceptable, a menace to the pristine heredity of the race. Once pegged as a special, a citizen, even if accepting sterilization, dropped out of history. He ceased, in effect, to be part of mankind. End quote. Given that these are UN-made rules, I guess the Secretary General might have a proclivity to funny mustaches. Anyway, my point is that beyond the obvious divisions between the rich and the poor, or androids and humans, the distinction between specials and their fellow men is the most disturbing. More than anything else, the fact that specials are sterilized and left to rot on Earth is a damning accusation against this dystopian society, especially when you consider that they simply suffer from low IQs but are otherwise just as empathic and spiritual as any other human. A point that is made crystal clear when examining that world's religion, which we will explore in the next part of this chapter. Like always, I wish to thank you for listening all the way to the end. And if you made it this far, why not consider supporting my work? Links in the description box. And remember, don't do to others what is hurtful to you. Don't let the bad guys win. See you in part 3.